This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, a tug of war between Silicon Valley and Washington. The Department of Justice is now involved in calls for social media's responsible content moderation. Former White House Chief Technology Officer Anish Chopra.
If you agree that there's a problem, that there's information online that's propagated that perhaps is doing more harm, then the question is, do you want to see more engagement to bring some of that information off? Or is do you want to see less?
And the head of the Anti-Defamation League says Facebook should be doing more to see less of that content, his Stop Hate for Profit campaign.
This company is worth almost $700 billion. The idea that they can't tackle this problem is, I think, laughable.
Plus, a conversation special to this podcast, Netflix CEO Reed Hastings donates $120 million to historically black colleges and raises the bar for corporate leaders.
We want to help draw attention to the HBCUs, to them being part of the solution for America and for black children to aspire to.
Those stories and more. It's Thursday, June 18th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
First up on today's podcast, the latest in big tech's tug of war with Washington, D.C. This week, the Department of Justice unveiled a proposal to Congress with recommended changes to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996. Dry, though that may sound, this legislation is critical to the way internet companies and social media moderate the content on their platforms and avoid legal retribution while doing so. It establishes internet companies as platforms rather than publishers, while still allowing those actors some say over what's posted there. Recode went so far as to call it the legal backbone of the internet. The DOJ's proposal suggests rolling back part of that backbone, specifically the immunity shield that protects internet platforms from liability for the content posted there. Under Section 230, as it stands, the Facebooks and Twitters of the world reserve the right to moderate anything they find obscene, lewd, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable. Among other things, the Department of Justice recommends removing that phrase, otherwise objectionable, on account of being too vague. This is all in the wake of President Trump's spat with Twitter last month after the platform started to fact-check for other users his tweets on voter fraud. That culminated in an executive order from the president seeking a scale-back of Section 230 and the protections it provides.
Thank you very much. We're here today to defend free speech from one of the gravest dangers it has faced in American history, frankly. A small handful of powerful social media monopolies controls a vast portion of all public and private communications.
Here's Joe Kernan with today's story.
Joining us now is Anish Chopra, the former White House Chief Technology Officer under President Obama, current president of Care Journey, a healthcare analytics firm. Anish, last time you were on, and that wasn't the only time, you've been begging for the industry to figure out how to do this with stakeholders in mind and how to do it themselves to prevent something like this. And they just, I don't know, they just have not. And now this is what you're seeing. It's a baby step, which it's not going to become law, do you think? But it just shows something's going on here that they should have tackled it themselves already.
Well, you know, it's a 25-year-old piece of legislation, and it's kept the industry in a reasonably strong footing. It's an obvious economic success story, but it was designed originally to give safe haven or room for the industry to do more to protect consumers. And we see today the challenges, misinformation, even amidst the pandemic, challenges around election interference, and even obviously historical challenges around terrorism and content around that. We have to see the industry do more. I will say several former colleagues of mine have now launched a professional society, getting the safety professionals and the working on the ground in these companies to come together to share best practices. But we have to do more to bring responsibility in these environments. And the industry can do this on its own. And the debate now is, does there need to be some baseline standards or requirements? And that's going to be a healthy part of the discussion. This piece of activity we're seeing here is more akin to political theater. But as we move forward, I think there is going to be an opportunity for a thoughtful discussion around how to set the right rules of the road for the next chapter of the internet.
politically, it's hard to figure out who's where. I mean, it's bizarre. It's like there are some strange bedfellows here. The DOJ, it looks like it's trying to thread the needle between extremes and find some middle ground, like leave the Section 230 in there, but make certain things, if they're, for example, criminal, then that would give you there's certain carve-outs you've had. But then you got someone like Vice President Biden wants to just get rid of Section 230, right? Because some people, it seems like the left is worried about election finagling, and the right's worried about conservative groups being kicked off of Twitter or Facebook. So you don't know. It's bizarre. Can you describe the landscape to me?
Just to give you a little perspective, if you agree that there's a problem, that there's information online that's propagated that perhaps is doing more harm, then the question is, do you want to see more engagement to bring some of that information off? Or do you want to see less? And I think that's the divide that you saw if you think of the good, the bad, and the ugly coming out of the DOJ report. The bad, if you were to think about, if you believe that there should be more misinformation, less moderation, then you might embrace some of the provisions in the DOJ report that say, look, unless it's absolutely, you know, criminal or very specifically, you know, narrowed, you can't really moderate. I'm not so sure that's where the majority of the American people are. I think the majority of the American people want to have honesty in our elections. They want to have some consistency and experience with respect to how misinformation is propagated. And to me, that means the industry should do more. And I think when you hear politicians on both sides of the aisle bring this issue up, the premise is in part, get the industry to move. But it's also to say failure to move is going to require us to set some baseline rules. You've seen this in the privacy debate where there's now almost bipartisan movement around establishing baseline fair information practice standards. So we have privacy protections on the internet. How we get there and finding a piece of legislation is going to take some time, but at least there's some rough consensus. In this area, the political parties seem to be at odds on whether we need more moderation or less. I'm on the more side, but I'm hopeful that the more will come from the industry getting a little bit more organized together on the ways we see it on the criminal side with intellectual property theft. If you accuse the platforms of stealing your copyright, your music, they have built technologies, they've built them to help identify those areas of copyright infringement, which is criminal. And they've moved some of that information in a more thoughtful way offline. So the notice and takedown procedures reflect a bit of an industry tether to get there. And we just need to see some of that on the misinformation and election interference side.
I don't know. I need it, Ben, frankly. I need Josh Hawley wants to revoke it. Yet most conservatives, if you revoked it, then they'd be complaining about frivolous litigation, which they hate. They want tort reform. So everybody's on the wrong side of where they normally are on a lot of these issues. So I don't know. I need help.
Out of the political lens and into the right answer for the economy. The right answer is this is an engine of economic growth. Companies are now more mature and have capabilities, and we still have room for disruptive innovators to come in.
Right. It's all subjective, though. I don't know how you write down a list of things that you definitely want to do when it's going to be subjective instead of objective. So it should be the industry itself needs to do this. Or you need to quit your job you're having, go back and help with this, Anish. Anyway, thanks. Appreciate it. And I'm sure we're going to need to talk to you again in a couple of weeks because this is not going away.
Meantime, yesterday, several civil rights organizations, including the Anti-Defamation League and the NAACP, took out a full-page ad in the Los Angeles Times urging big advertisers to boycott Facebook next month. The campaign, hashtag Stop Hate for Profit, is in response to what the group says is Facebook's repeated failures to address hate on its platform. CEO Mark Zuckerberg, who's also faced criticism from inside his own company, says people will now be able to opt out of seeing political ads on Facebook. Joining us right now is Jonathan Greenblatt. He's the CEO and the national director of the Anti-Defamation League. Good morning to you, Jonathan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about this effort and tell us specifically, you've been in talks with Facebook for quite some time about this issue. What's the back and forth been like?
It's been challenging. We have been working with Facebook for years. We have a center in Silicon Valley that deals with hate speech and social media. And Facebook, which is far and away the largest such platform in the world, we've been engaged with them over the years to finally do something about hate speech. And we felt like in the wake of the death of George Floyd, it had just reached a boiling point, which is why the NAACP, Color of Change, Common Sense Media, Sleeping Giants, Free Press, all these groups came together to finally say it's time for Facebook to do something. It's time to stop hate for profit.
And so what have your conversations been with advertisers? Because as you know, advertisers have been reluctant to jump into these debates. And frankly, given the fact that Facebook has such a large market share in terms of online advertising, especially during this pandemic, I imagine it must make it harder for businesses to make a decision like this.
Well, yes and no. We've actually had a number of conversations with big Fortune 500 brands we're talking to right now. Remember, the campaign just launched yesterday. But what's important is that this isn't a boycott to permanently abandon Facebook as an advertising platform. This isn't a walkout to say you should never use the service. This is a pause to show Facebook that there are consequences when it doesn't deal with the racism on the platform, when it doesn't deal with the conspiracy theories on the platform, when it doesn't deal with the anti-Semitism and Holocaust denialism on the platform, and frankly, all forms of hate. I mean, at the ADL, we track extremists, and we found white nationalists literally using Facebook to organize their efforts to disrupt the protests over the past several weeks. We saw examples on Facebook of conspiracy theories that George Floyd was paying protesters, that George Soros, excuse me, was paying protesters, or that George Floyd was some kind of actor. Look, the time has come for the company to say, we are not going to allow this kind of hate, which is further dividing our country, to proliferate on their platform. And businesses can make these decisions all the time. Businesses have the right to say what will happen in their store or on their service and what they won't tolerate. And I think as the country struggles with issues of racial justice, as the country struggles with issues of extraordinary division, we think rather than waiting for Washington to act, business has a role to play to say, we support the quest for racial justice. We support the quest to tackle hate. And we want to push Facebook, show Facebook that if they don't take action, the bottom line will suffer.
You mentioned government and waiting for government to act. You know what's now on the table. Do you think that Facebook and other social media platforms should be liable for the information that's on their service?
Yeah, I saw Joe's talk with my former colleague, Anish Chopra, just a few minutes ago. 230 is very complicated. The reason why we have the internet that we know today, from Facebook to Wikipedia to so many other services, is literally because of the creative latitude that 230 provides. But let me tell you something. When they drafted that, you know, 20 some odd years ago, the intent wasn't to think that companies would allow neo-Nazis to manipulate their services. The thought wasn't that it would allow racism to proliferate. So whether the company should be liable or not, whether they have a legal liability, I would argue they have a moral liability to do more to make sure that all of their users are safe and secure.
Right. Jonathan, let me ask you this. You know, we had Mark Zuckerberg on the program actually just a couple of weeks ago.
Some of the stuff that people share on the internet is real junk, and it's completely made up, and you don't want that stuff to be the stuff that's going the most viral. So we have a program where we work with independent fact checkers on that to make sure that things that are completely hoaxes can be limited in their spread. But that's, you know, the point of that program isn't to like try to parse words on is something slightly true or false. It's really to catch the worst of the worst stuff. In terms of political speech, again, I think you want to give broad deference to the political process and political speech.
And I don't want to speak for him, but I believe if he was here today, he would say, look, we've made a lot of strides on this issue. We may not catch everything. We are trying. Do you believe they're trying? Is it an issue of that they're not trying hard enough, that they're not taking this seriously enough? Is this an issue of bad algorithms and just a whack-a-mole game that's almost impossible to win? What do you think is happening inside Facebook?
Well, I think there are a few things. Look, I've dealt with Mark and Sheryl and so many executives there. They are good people and they have made some effort, but not nearly enough. they need to apply the same urgency that they apply to copyright protection. And look, this company is worth almost $700 billion. It is one of the most innovative companies in the history of the markets. I mean, literally what they've been able to do, it's WhatsApp, it's Oculus, it's Portal, it's Insta, and it's Facebook. The idea that they can't tackle this problem is, I think, laughable, but they need to feel the urgency. And if Fortune 500 brands knew, at ADL, we have found many examples of Fortune 500 brands flighted against QAnon conspiracies, flighted against white nationalist content, flighted against some of the worst things that I know have nothing to do with these brands.
Jonathan, we appreciate you joining us, and we hope to have you back. Understand how this progresses over time.
Next on Squawk Pod, Netflix CEO Reed Hastings on his $120 million donation to historically black colleges and universities.
This moment is not the first time that racism's reared its, you know, terribly ugly head. And many of us have been working on these issues for a long time.
The full conversation that you'll hear only on this podcast right after this. This is Squawk Pod. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings is committing $120 million to institutions dedicated to the higher education of students of color. Hastings will donate $40 million each to the UNCF and historically black Spelman and Morehouse colleges. It is the largest individual gift ever in support of student scholarships at historically black colleges and universities. The donation from Hastings and his wife, Patty Quillen, comes amid new renewed calls for racial justice after the police killing of George Floyd, an unarmed black man in Minneapolis. And the black community has been disproportionately sickened by the coronavirus, showing the gaping disparities in access to quality health care across minority communities. Andrew Ross Sorkin spoke with Hastings and the leaders of those three institutions. You'll hear from them all in this next interview special to Squawk Pod. Mary Schmidt Campbell is the president of Spelman College. David Thomas is the president of Morehouse. And Michael Lomax is the CEO of UNCF. Here's Andrew.
Thank you, all of you, for doing this, and congratulations. Reed, I want to start with you just to understand how this came about.
You know, I've been working in education, K-12 primarily, for more than 20 years. And Dr. Michael Lomax and I are on a board together of KIPP Public Schools. It's 100,000 kids, Latino and Black kids in America, who get a great education and go on to college. And through that time, he helped me realize that there's many good places to donate. But the HBCUs in America are 150 years old, incredibly resilient, producing amazing numbers of black graduates, and that I should be open to think about those schools also. And then he got me to come down and visit Spelman and Morehouse. And Patty, my wife, and I were just blown away, not by these great presidents on this call, they're very nice, but by the students. And what it meant for them to be just surrounded by so many black scholars, and how reinforcing it was. And so we're stepping up with this $120 million gift. You know, we want to help draw attention to the HBCUs, to them being part of the solution for America and for black children to aspire to. And so we're so proud. But really, the credit is with Dr. Lomax.
Can you speak briefly just to this moment in terms of the impetus?
You know, this moment is not the first time that racism's reared its, you know, terribly ugly head. And many of us have been working on these issues for a long time. Again, for me, mostly through education and my visits and my understanding of my relationships with all of my colleagues here was all pre this crisis. But then you bring COVID in and the stress. I mean, the typical black family knows many more COVID victims than the typical white family because COVID has hit so hard in the black community. And then, of course, you've got the police violence and the killings. And so the amount of tragedy really did get us to focus and say, let's do something now that will be supportive of these great institutions and give people some sense of hope.
Mary, tell us how this is going to change things for the university. You know,
you look at the endowments of some of these great historically black colleges in America, and they are in the hundreds of millions of dollars at best. And then you look at the Harvards of the world, and they're not just in the billions, but at 40 plus billion dollars.
Yes. The fact of the matter is that the gift that Patty and Reed has made is really transformational. You talk about the endowment. It's not just that we don't have the same resources. It's that we've taken on the responsibility of educating more of our students who are without financial resources themselves. 60% of Morehouse's students are eligible for Pell, 48% of Spelman's. That means that virtually half of our populations come from families that make $40,000 or less. So here you have in this country, you have the colleges with the least resources taking on the responsibility of educating at a high level the students who need resources most. And so having Patty and Reed make this contribution is especially important because they've spent a lifetime thinking about and committing and investing in eliminating educational inequity. Spelman's been a college partner with KIPP for several years now. And so we know how important it is to start that investment from preschool right on up through high school and into college. And they've been there every step of the way. So to have them affirm the kind of work that we do at Spelman and Morehouse is to say to the country, this is really important, necessary work.
David, let's talk about getting more donations because we got to get more money into these universities and colleges. Let me ask you this: you got a great donation about a year ago now from Robert Smith. But how important is to try to find money outside of your own alumni base?
It's very important, and the reality is that, for example, in our alumni base, we have many. Alumni have done quite well, but I don't think we have any billionaires. And so what Robert Smith did last year, what Patty and Reed are doing now, allows us to transform at an accelerated rate of speed. And the reality is that we have to do more and do it faster.
Right.
To a better place, to continue to get the best students who have opportunities to go other places, and in some cases, no choice because they don't have family who have extra resources to give them. And our ability to continue to attract those students makes us attractive, more attractive even to those students who have resources to pay.
Right. Let me bring Michael into the conversation. Michael, in a perfect world, blue sky, how much money do you need right now? We're going to do almost like a telethon here. If we could raise for you today, I'm not joking. How much money, I mean, don't say unlimited, but how much money do you think you could use and need today that would be game changing?
So UNCF has an HBCU Strategic Impact Investment Fund. I have been rebuilding that fund for the last 2 weeks. Today it stands at $60 million. It needs to be at $1 billion. The near-term focus of this fund is the reopening of our Black colleges with strong enrollments, safe environments for our students, and great technology and in-person teaching. But the long-term goal is full recovery and transformation. To achieve both the short-term goal and the long-term goal, $1 billion in the UNCF Strategic Impact Investment Fund.
Andrew, we actually did the calculation for Spelman to determine what was the gap after all financial aid had been expended. What was the financial gap that remained? And it's about $40 million a year that still has to be closed for our students. And I would venture to guess it's the same at Morehouse. And then we did the calculation, well, what kind of endowment would you need for that? So We got those figures.
So Reed, let me come back to you. I'm not asking you for all the money this moment, but let me ask you this. You have a lot of colleagues who've had a lot of success, and I'm thinking of people like Mayor Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg, who's, who gave $1.8 billion to Johns Hopkins, and a lot of other successful people with remarkable careers who've given to a lot of the Ivy League schools and others. What do you tell them? Have you had conversations with them about this and this potential opportunity?
You know, we all tend to give to the institutions that we know and love. And, you know, when I started, I've been mostly donating to a wonderful college that I went to, Bowdoin College in Maine. And it was really the work of Michael Lomax in helping me to get to know the HBCU system that really opened it up. So I think we'll start now, you know, with this donation of sort of maybe an idea of, you know, if you're going to give a big gift to your alma mater, go ahead and do that. But also give one to the HBCUs. And the easy way to start is with UNCF because it's broad, it's sort of the united way of the system. And then you can get to know the individual institution. So giving both to your own alma mater and giving to the HBCUs is a great way to go.
Let me ask you a question as a corporate leader in this environment at this particular moment and also recognizing that Netflix has done a lot better than a number of the other Silicon Valley companies when it comes to creating a diverse workforce. You have about 8% African Americans at Netflix, at least that's what's been disclosed publicly, I'm sure you want to do better than that, but on a relative basis to the rest of the Valley, what do you think you're doing right and what do you think you have still some work to do?
Well, mostly we have a long way to go. You know, in the U.S., Black people are about 13-14% of the population. So, you know, we significantly underskew. Some of that is because we're in California. But we're working on all aspects of it. We've doubled in the last 3 years, the percentages. So they were 3-4%. And, you know, they've come all up a lot. And, you know, it's a lot of the contact networks that people have of, you know, how do you get in? And we forget how much the social glue and we have relative social isolation between the large Black community and white communities. You know, on the margin, there's connectivity and that's great. So those are some of the factors that we're looking to overcome and to continue to increase both our representation and our inclusion and trying to be a Black-friendly organization. Right. It's amazing how easy it is to even a company that's trying hard like Netflix not be that comfortable for Black employees at times. And so, you know, it's something that we all have to work on. Our Black employees work on it hard and the rest of us work on it also.
Squawk Pod. We'll be right back. You're listening to Squawk Pod from CNBC. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Meantime, if you're a music fan, Spotify reaching a deal with reality star. I shouldn't say a music fan. If you keep AirPods in your ears all the time, Kim Kardashian West is now going to be hosting a podcast focused on criminal justice. You can only listen to it on Spotify. Terms have not been disclosed. The show will be connected to her work with the Innocence Project, a nonprofit that fights wrongful convictions. And Spotify has been trying to lock up a lot of exclusive deals with popular podcasts. Last month, you might remember, it struck a licensing deal worth more than $100 million for Joe Rogan's podcast, what's now considered, I believe, the most popular podcast in the country. May be a good time to also mention that you should listen to our podcast, which you can get on Spotify, too, Squawk Pod, every weekday featuring news, interviews, and behind-the-scenes access. We're available everywhere, guys. It's Spotify. You can get it on Apple. Wherever your favorite podcast can be found.
What did Rogan get? What there was a number out there or something? Do you remember?
The number out there is 100. I think, to be honest, based even on my own reporting, and I think it's actually higher than 100. I think it's probably in the 100.
For a podcast.
150-ish range for a podcast. It's basically, but he's doing the equivalent... With daily radio show.
But like, I haven't decided what to do with our podcast money yet. You know what I mean? I don't have a place in Florida.
Right.
I haven't spent any of it. I guess because I haven't seen any of it. Is there any? How does this work here?
I haven't seen it either.
You haven't either?
I think they pay you based on your talent.
You know what you guys should have said? Both of you said you should have said you're getting paid. It's like, really? You haven't made anything?
You haven't got yours.
Okay,
your check?
We're all on the same boat.
They pay us all based on the amount of talent and effort
that we put into it. I go to the mailbox every morning.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thank you for listening. This would be a good time to tell you that Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. This podcast is produced by me, Katie Kramer, Cameron Costa, and Caroline O'Brien. John Lazration is our editor. So, Spotify, you better send separate checks. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.